And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Sitting in for Dean Lily Holloman.
This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and this is your friend in podcasting. Phil Lairness coming at you from a historic building, an historic building in the heart of where old Hollywood began. And indeed, I am joined not by Dean Haglund, but by Miss Lily Holloman. Lily, thanks for jumping into the fray at very much the last minute.
Meow.
Was that you or was that Fuzz Aldrin?
Well, I'm speaking on behalf of us both and for Dean in Australia.
Yes, indeed.
Rolling in that paper laughs money as we speak.
All right. Well, that is a reference to, of course, Dean Haglund, to Dean Haglund's comedy shows in Newtown, where he has not been performing. He's actually been very much pay per ticket in terms of his comedy. Ooh. They're at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival the last couple of weeks. And we're coming at you half a day later than usual because Dean wanted to move the recording time so that he could get back from Melbourne and get a good night's sleep, from which he has apparently not awakened.
He has not gotten up yet. Still dreaming.
This is a Chilpack Hollywood Hour first where Dean Haglund simply sleeps through a show. He's phoned in shows before. He's slept walk through many shows before. He's nary paid a moment of attention to anything going on in shows before, but never has he literally kept his head on the pillow and not bothered to Skype in.
Oh no, you're selling him short. This is his dream of the podcast.
Oh. So is he going to wake up in bed with Bob Newhart?
I think so.
That's all of our dreams. unfortunately, we have a script, not a script, but we have show notes to go through that, honestly, there's no time to change. So let's get right to it, shall we?
We shall.
Dean, how was the Melbourne International Comedy Festival?
Oh, I gotta tell you, it was just great. I mean, the laughs and the people and the games and the improv and the down under. It's just,
oh my god, wow. Who did you just become there?
I don't know,
some borscht belt comic. So Dean, you're back in Newtown there in Sydney for a little bit of time, but then you're flying to New Orleans. Why are you going to be in New Orleans?
What? I had no idea I was going to New Orleans. This is exciting news.
And then you'll be back for one day only here in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. We hope he wakes up in time for that appearance.
Yes, because whenever I'm in the United States, the vicinity of the US of A, I must make an appearance at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, as should every American, if you call yourself an American.
Part of what Dean and I were going to talk about on the show, because we do enjoy, as longtime listeners know, having production meetings on the air, we were going to decide what his improv game was going to be. At the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, he's ostensibly going to be giving a presentation based on his new book, which is an illustrated guide to historic buildings on Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. That's a really awkward, unwordy, unwieldy title. I don't think that's the exact title. But he's going to be giving a presentation based on his book. He's going to be showing his art and talking about the history of some of the great buildings on Broadway in the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, from whence this particular podcast used to record. Anywho, after that presentation, we were going to coerce him, strong-arm him into doing an improv game. And I wanted to decide with Dean what that was going to be. I'm thinking sentences. Do you know sentences?
Sentences, where the audience writes down a sentence.
Sentence, that... a question, a statement, something. And yes. And then the participants in the game carry on a conversation largely scripted through these unseen sentences contributed by the audience.
Indeed. So if I write, I would like a ham sandwich, you would say?
Well, I know the perfect place to give you a ham sandwich. No, I might respond with another sentence. I can't know what I would respond with because it's being written for me and submitted. You see what I'm saying? And I thought it could be, the setup could be Dean is playing himself, and he is a tour guide in downtown Los Angeles, and these are questions that he gets from tourists.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Would that be fun?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dean. You know, we have to say goodbye and remember a beloved, award-winning entertainer in something, Lily, we like to call celebrity deaths, and so we do.
Celebrity deaths.
That's what I said, Garrett Watley. Patty Duke died. Did you see this, Lil?
I did see this. I told you, actually, that she died.
So, yeah, you were very excited because you won the Deadpool.
Yeah. Well, I grew up watching Cousins, you know, because they're cousins, identical cousins. Yes, they are. They look alike. They talk alike. They really, really look alike. Great lyrics.
Born Anna Marie Duke in the New York City borough of Queens, she grew up in a troubled home.
Aw.
I'm not quite sure what that entailed. Under the stage name Patty Duke, she stunned Broadway audiences at the age of 12 as the young deaf and blind Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker, a role she reprised in the 1962 film opposite Anne Bancroft. And she won an Oscar for that performance. Patty Duke did. She also won notice as well for what may have been the shortest acceptance speech in Oscar history, where she simply said, thank you. Unless someone goes up and says thanks, or just, I don't know what, sticks up a middle finger, there's never going to be a shorter acceptance speech than that. You would have thought that at least she would have signed it, wouldn't you? I don't know.
Why?
For deaf, to honor the deaf.
I
don't know. Anyway, she was the star of the Patty Duke Show. Now, I guess the theme you were singing and what you referred to as Cousins is the Patty Duke Show.
Yes.
Okay. Because she did. She played the dual roles of Patty Lane of Brooklyn and her so-called identical cousin, Kathy Lane of Scotland.
Well, I think she really qualifies in the category of a snickerdoodle. I adore Patty Duke. Her performing was always so open and vulnerable and heartbreaking. And I also love her in Valley of the Dolls.
I've got nothing for that, Lil.
Nothing?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the Valley. I mean, I know of the Valley of the Dolls, but I have not seen it. I mean,
Tour de force.
All right. Okay. I do. What I recall of her, you're quite right. She was very open as a performer. She was also very open in real life, of course. In 1982, she was finally diagnosed with an illness that she had been battling all her life, which is bipolar disorder, and she was quite open and outspoken about this fact. She became a leading advocate for mental health and for diagnosis of the disorder. Thereafter, in 1988, she did an interview on CBS where she had a message for anyone who is suffering through a cycle of emotional highs and lows. She said, go to a doctor. That's the main thing. Get to the doctor and continue to go until it is determined that you are either manic depressive or that you have some other problem. You know, she was a past president of the Screen Actors Guild. That's two Screen Actors Guild presidents to drop in the last 2 weeks. You like to think that both of them knew that they could leave the stage feeling as if their beloved union was in good hands and well set up for the future. You like to think that.
I would like to think so.
She is a three-time Emmy winner. And let me look at what these Emmy wins were for. She was nominated for a Primetime Emmy for playing Lily in The Woman's Room. And she was nominated for children's programming for The Girl on the Edge of Town that same year. Those both were in 81. And she was nominated for George Washington for playing Martha Washington in 84. Nominated for guest actress in a drama series for Touched by an Angel in 99. So she was still very active through the years. And won a Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Comedy or Musical way back in 1970 for Me, Natalie, which is a film I don't know.
No love for Valley of the Dolls.
Sorry. Let's give some love to some movies, though, Lily Holloman, before we get into the big news in Hollywood, which is what has got to be the most hated superhero movie of all time, not just by critics, but it's safe to say that it's the most hated superhero movie of all time by audiences. Let's deal with the positive, though, first, if we can.
Let's do it.
Because we have seen a couple of movies recently that were well worth people's time, not the least of which was Zootopia.
Oh, we love the Zootopia.
And why? Why do we love that?
Well, first of all, the lead bunny character reminds us of our cat Fuzz.
Okay, but that's a little bit of a limited appeal for that movie. And yet, the box office for this film certainly would indicate that the film is belying that limited appeal.
Well, Fuzz is a bigger deal than you're giving her credit for, so I will say that. But it is all in all appealing. You know, you and I have the initial resistance to go see animated films. We go to the screenings of the DGA that are part of a series, and so we go to everything.
And that, for those who don't know, stands for the Directors Guild of A.
Yes. And so we're often resistant to the animation, but we usually leave very satisfied feeling. The movie Zootopia especially has a lot of heart, a lot of humor, a lot of deeper themes about following your passion, about living a full life of service, and everyone treating each other as equals. So there were a lot of large themes involved in the Zootopia.
We do see a lot of animated films, though. I don't know why you're saying there's resistance. I think historically, I don't like cartoons. I've been forthright about that. I have a hard time with cartoons traditionally, and yet I've opened myself to the classic Disney shorts. For example, I'm wearing a pair of Disney shorts right now.
And, you never wear shorts.
And no, I do not. I have a hard time with the short format, even episodic TV of animated shows. Your Kings of the Hills, your Simpsons, love the Simpsons movie, love the South Park movie, can't bring myself to watch episodes of these shows. It's very, very difficult. I'll cherry pick certain episodes when I know what they're about and I'll sit down. But there is something about the form that's very difficult for me. Although that said, I did binge watch what was that show that Dean loved so much and championed?
Archer?
No, I've only ever watched a couple episodes of that. And very funny. And I love Kid Notorious. Very funny. But the one with Stephen Colbert and Gary Cole.
Mm-hmm.
What's that thing called? The Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law. Yes.
No, there's a lot of good animation out there. It's just there's a little bit of something I have to get through upon the initial reaction.
I wonder what that is. I don't quite know. But I do, yes, I do enjoy animated films. I don't think I have any resistance towards it at all. I just am at the point where I wish they didn't all have to follow action film structures. They're all action movies.
Yes. In fact, I was, I babysit for a couple of kids every now and again, and they like when we're on long drives for me to tell them stories. And this is so indicative of how kids' movies are. I like to kind of delve into these conversations that the characters are having. And one of the little girls cut me off and she said, "Is this going to be all talking or is there going to be any action in this story?" And, you know, everyone's a critic. That's what the kids want, so that's what they're delivering.
I just received a message from Dean Hagland. The subject heading is fuck. The message begins, "Sorry, roof is leaking all morning and I have to sign some legal documents in 20 minutes. 9:30 a.m. his time. We were scheduled for 7 a.m. Of course, 9:30 a.m. will be far too late. But Dean will be back with us next week. I'm going out of order on this, but since he just wrote, he will be back next week, and it's very exciting because we'll be welcoming a very special guest, Leah Meyerhoff, the founder of Film Fatales, an organization that was first discussed on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour by none other than you, Lily Holloman, and your guest co-host, Karen Foreman, when the two of you took over this show for a few episodes last summer. And you talked about Film Fatales releasing their list of classic female-directed films upon which, that inspired the work of Film Fatales and recent female-directed films that everyone should see.
Yes.
And Dean and I took it upon ourselves to try to watch all those films and discuss them. And we've done an okay job of sticking to that. But we're excited to have the founder of Film Fatales on the show to talk about the organization, to talk about diversity in the business and the importance of it, and to talk about her own storytelling. She directed a film that I raved about on this show. So that'll be on next week's show. I will make sure, come literally, apparently, hell or high water, that Dean joins us. Now, a film that you and I at first weren't enjoying, then we started to enjoy, and that in retrospect it was certainly less than the sum of its parts, I think it's safe to say, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. This is almost out of theaters now, so I'm resistant to even bring it up, except that there was a really interesting conversation that we had about Tina Fey playing the lead role. No one is a bigger Tina Fey fan than yours truly.
And myself.
No one is a bigger Tina Fey fan than me. No.
Okay.
I defy you.
All right.
And yet this was bad casting. She produced it herself, cast herself in it, and it was bad casting. And why was it bad casting, Lil?
It could have been better casting if they had worked it a little bit more. But Tina Fey is very much a persona in her acting. She has the Tina Fey persona. It works really well, works brilliantly in so many things. And this movie sort of was begging for a more embodied disappear into the character portrayal.
So that we could believe it.
So that we could believe it.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to get over the hump of the ubiquitous nature of Tina Fey's persona that we all know in the public and love.
And I think it's at a certain point we do, which is great.
Yes.
However, again, there are then scenes of exposition that have to explain to us after the fact why characters did what they did, especially the main character. And if someone had been cast who could embody the truths of this character, then we would have seen those truths for ourselves, and maybe they still would have needed to be explained later, but when they were explained, we would have said, ah, that's what we were witnessing.
Right.
Instead of being aware that we weren't witnessing that at all.
Right.
And we're only being told that it was what happened and what was being felt. So I guess we have to accept that as justification for what took place. And that is, at best, an intellectual satisfaction. It isn't a visceral or emotional satisfaction.
There's also a certain laziness that I think filmmakers take on when somebody is as famous as Tina Fey. They just kind of bank on the popularity of the actor and don't do the real work and don't really pay attention to the close details to make it the best movie possible. I also would like to declare a moratorium on a certain comedic trait that movies have taken on recently, which is the list, the never-ending list build that these comedies feel like they have to have. I think it was first introduced in Knocked Up by Seth Rogen, maybe a little bit earlier than that.
I think Vince Vaughn is...
Oh, Vince Vaughn,
this is,
sure.
What you're talking about here is when a comedic performer goes off on a riff,
yes,
that is kind of a list of jokes or metaphors or euphemisms.
Yes, Wedding Crashers was kind of the beginning of that, actually, yeah.
You know, and the problem is never with the people who start this.
No, it's the copycats. It's tired. It slows the movie down. It's not necessary anymore.
And
please,
Melissa McCarthy is a big, practitioner of list-based comedy.
It's exhausting. Please stop.
And
I beg of you, comedy public filmmakers.
Exhausting.
Stop.
Please stop. was ultimately our feeling about Spy, which certainly started off so promising and got very nice reviews. I heard so many good things about it that ultimately we set aside our skepticism to watch a film that very much proved our skepticism.
We no longer have room in our comedic movies for actors who are going to comment on their performances. We crave truthful, real performances that are comedic.
And it's fascinating because here I am complaining about how animated movies all have to be action films. Now apparently all studio comedies have to be action films.
Yes.
Because it's the only way to guarantee them the huge box office. They all have to be, and this is one of the ways I think, again, Anchorman 2 might be a little bit underrated in terms of it having a lot going on in its head. You know, it was not only a very nice satire of what 24-hour news would do to society and has done to society, but it also kind of comments on this whole thing about how ultimately comedy films have to now be structured like action films, and the climaxes have to be played out as action, with the gigantic war scene at the end of Anchorman 2, which is hilarious. But I think it's hilarious because it's kind of acknowledging how bankrupt comedy structures have become when there's a big budget involved.
It's all a formula, and there's no real connective tissue that makes you care. I just completely tuned out at the end of Spy because what am I supposed to care about? I don't understand.
You know...
just because it's funny doesn't mean I care.
And it's interesting because I'm about to segue into a genre of which I was never a particularly big fan, and that is the horror genre. And yet I am finding with each passing year, at least individual representations of that genre that are wonderfully inventive in terms of their approach to narrative structure in a way that action films are not. And horror films for so long were the poster child of formula.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw, as you know, 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I've been trying to see any good horror releases because I'm involved in rewriting a horror film right now. And I was so pleased by 10 Cloverfield Lane. I don't think I ever found it scary, but I was pleased by it because here's a film that literally changes what movie it is, what genre it is, not every few minutes, but quite often during the length of its running time. So having, as you know, just produced a film together called The Lady Killers, the criticism of which in some quarters is, well, what movie is this? It becomes a different movie at different times. Well, here's 10 Cloverfield Lane that finds a way to turn that criticism into a strength, and they lead with it in their marketing campaign with a very clever ad line. There are many kinds of monsters.
In some ways, the horror film is sort of an abandoned playground right now in which anyone can do anything because everyone's really focused on the action comedy.
Well, you're right that if you keep a budget under a certain level, they know what their multiples are going to be in a horror film. They know how it'll sell foreign.
Yeah.
So you get a certain freedom
to
play within the form that you don't get to do elsewhere. It's almost like in the golden era of Hollywood Westerns. Why Westerns have stood the test of time as works of art is because of their subtextual relevance and also their play often with the narrative form. Because as long as you were giving certain, as long as you were hitting the checklist, of course, at a certain budget with certain names, that Western is a green light for production.
Mm-hmm.
So you're playing around with the margins of it. And I feel like horror might just be that way. When we look back, horror might be the contemporary Western.
Yeah.
Where we are exploring, just like with the Western, certain mythological archetypal ideas of individual freedom versus society's restrictions. Anyway, so it's an interesting, fun movie, 10 Cloverfield Lane, unrelated to the first Cloverfield, as far as I can tell, in any way other than what company John Goodman's character works for. That's the only connective tissue in it. And apparently J.J. Abrams' Bad Robot team are producing a third one in the Cloverfield universe. Although it's interesting because I believe this second one can't take place in the same universe as the first one. It seems like it contradicts that the first one could have taken place. But I don't quote me on that. Why would you? But the third one apparently might explain how they're all tied in, which could be kind of fun, a la what Ridley Scott's doing with his Alien Prometheus spinoff. Apparently, there's going to be multiple movies, and you'll find out how they're all connected. I don't know. Anyway, 10 Cloverfield Lane was fun, and I definitely want to catch this horror film that's been doing very, very good business, set in, what, 1630, The Witch, set in New England,
yes.
I believe it is, in 1630. It's supposed to be exquisite and terrifying. And it's a directorial debut for Robert Eggers. It feels like it's this year's It Follows.
It's interesting because some of these horror films are doing well, and I didn't see 10 Cloverfield Lane, but does it have... Because we had to turn off Mommy. What was the one?
Goodnight, Mommy.
Goodnight, Mom. We had to turn that off because we realized it was about to get horrifyingly exploitive and violent, and so there still is that type of horror film that exists, but I do feel like there's this new subgenre that's not quite that way, that's still making money and popular and satisfying on a visceral level, like The Babadook, like It Follows.
Yeah, yeah. And Ex Machina, I think, borrows a lot from horror. It is more in the sci-fi, but of course science fiction and horror have always had an interesting relationship with each other. I caught up on, as you know, I always set it upon myself to see every film on the Metacritic consensus list each year. And the next to last one I needed to catch was Spike Lee's Chi-Raq.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the last time Spike Lee sniffed, even came near a Metacritic consensus list. So it's nice to think that Spike Lee has rediscovered a certain relevancy. You watched some of this with me. You asked, is this any good? And I said, yes, it is any good. It is a workout, this movie, Chirac.
It seemed like a really admirable effort. I admired what they were trying to do.
It's an adaptation of the Greek play Lysistrata. Is that the pronunciation of it?
Mm-hmm.
The title Chirac comes from the idea that there's more urban deaths in Chicago than there are of combat soldiers in Iraq. And, you know, it is polemic. It is essay, which is kind of par for the course with Spike Lee. He makes important statements, and a lot of times he fails to tell a story. And that was certainly true here. There really ultimately is no story. It's satire, and they try to cloak themselves in terms of their marketing with being a satire in the vein of Dr. Strangelove. And I would say hold it right there. Because in Dr. Strangelove, you have story that comes out of character. And not only are these characters fleshed out, but you root for them. You root for the president. You root even for General Ripper, who tells his point of view of why he's done this, the fluoridation of water, Mandrake. You root for Kong, who's leading the bomber, and his crew. You root for them. You're rooting for conflicting interests in this. That's a sign that a story is being told. A story that is grabbing you, that is immersing you. There is nothing like this in Chirac, so it's a different kind of satire, and much more sketch-based, honestly. And there is literally no insight at all into the mentality that creates these circumstances. Dr. Strangelove immerses you in the mentality that allows such insanity to exist and to proliferate. Chirac, there is no insight.
Well, they created a huge challenge for themselves in that the entire movie is in poetic verse.
Which was one of the things that made me root for it.
Exactly. And I wanted it to be good too. But, it seemed to become the tail that wagged the dog. And I'm the first one to say, if you're an actor who can do Shakespeare and you need to be having done that type of acting for many, 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 many years in order to fully integrate, it's a different language. I know that, I guess, Spike Lee wrote this poetic verse and it's different from Shakespeare, but it did feel like the actors were trying to keep up with making it sound conversational and not necessarily rooting it in real characters.
Well, and you know, I think throughout this, and this is often the criticism and the weakness of Spike Lee's films, the style always is the tail that wags the dog, not just the style of performance, but his style, the editing style, the camera style. It is the tail that wags the dog instead of being a method of showing us how characters perceive the world. When it works great, like Do the Right Thing, it's groundbreaking, it's towering. In this, it is tiring, not towering. And I watched it because I felt I should. I rooted for it because I felt I should. And at the same time, I said, who is the audience for this? Is this going to affect change? Is this going to have an impact that he wishes it would, when I feel the audience that needs to see it will be totally uninterested in this kind of presentation? And so the audience is critics. And, you know, it's not surprising that the critics support this film and champion it. And it's quite honestly, it's heartening that they champion it because the film needs it. But, you know, as I always point out, critics will give the benefit of the doubt to films whose heart and conscience is in the right place. Lesser so they will champion films that are trying to break new ground stylistically. Of course, this film does both, so that explains the critical response to it.
I think it was worth being made, 100%, and I salute them. And if they want to keep trying this style to see if they can deepen it and make it work, I would support that effort. It's clearly the first try in a brand new genre.
And honestly, those that have criticized Spike Lee for not showing anything about what life is actually like in Chicago, this is where, if you're storytellers and you're criticizing it, tell your own story. You do that then. If that matters to you, you don't have to criticize this film. Tell your own, make your own film. Tell your own story. Do that. Let this be a beginning to the conversation. Don't make the debate over it be the end of the conversation. We did see a fantastic movie the other night. As part of the 5th annual Wayne Fetterman International Film Festival, we saw a movie introduced. It was introduced by Keegan-Michael Key at CineFamily in Hollywood. A special shout out to our loyal listener, Nicole Hockenberry Baumer. Bomer. Bow. who made this more than possible. We saw a film that I'm shocked at myself for never having seen before, 1987's With Nail and I, from writer-director Bruce Robinson, starring Paul McCann, future Doctor. I think he's the Eighth Doctor, is that right? Who knows? Honestly, who cares? And the wonderful actor Richard E. Grant, whose career began. Also starring as Uncle Monty, the late, great Richard Griffiths, most recently acclaimed as Uncle Vernon Dursley in the... in the Harry Potter movies, but With Nail and I, a comedy about two resting actors.
I love that term. I'm calling myself that from now on.
At the very tail end of the 1960s. This was such a delightful film, was it not?
It was delightful. Truly, truly delightful. The dialogue, the atmosphere, the performances were all... It's hard to describe. It's set in the 1960s and
felt like it could have been made in the 1960s.
Exactly.
It was not 1987 looking at what the 60s were like. It really felt like it was made then. So it's interesting because you really kind of get a feel of it as a time capsule piece in a way so many films commenting on the 60s or trying to recapture the style.
It both honored and recaptured the energy of the 60s and defined the energy of the late 80s simultaneously, which I can't really pinpoint how they did that, but I will say that it honored the ambiguity of time, because there's never been a decade that doesn't include remnants from previous decades. It's ambiguous. It's full of people holding on to their pasts. And that's why it's so refreshing to me to discover independent film from the 1980s, because I was a kid in the 1980s and the big budget studio films confuse me, because that was not my experience. The big hair and the crazy clothes and the cocaine parties had nothing to do with how I experienced the 1980s and in this.
I'm glad, honestly, that the cocaine parties was not what you knew as a 6-year-old. I think that's great. Look.
But to be able to see this film and most recently also Repo Man, I'm starting to feel this energy. It's hard to describe, except for it's an artist's capturing of a specific energy that existed in that time.
I do love how British independent films of the 80s feel like Hollywood movies of the 70s. You know, boy, filmmaking was as good as it would ever get in Hollywood in the 1970s. There was such texture, such nuance, and such depth to these films. And then it all changes with Star Wars. It changes with the advent of VHS. Films suddenly were about opening huge on opening weekend. Nationwide, that had never really happened before. You need to get the biggest audience possible. So now the budgets are exploding exponentially to try to get those big audiences. And the studios would start making fewer and fewer films, of course, because these films were costing so much more money. And in an effort to try to draw a bigger audience. But with that more money and in an effort to draw a bigger audience and to roll out more prints, marketing costs went up exponentially. And so the irony is that here we are these decades later, and it's all about blockbusters. It's all about franchise tent poles. And yet the margin of profits for these companies has never gone up. It's exactly, if a film company is profitable, it's the exact same margin of profit that they used to be when they were making so many more films, and quite honestly, so many more good films, and they were employing so many more people who could earn a living. Now there's fewer movies, and the margin of profit has not changed. The margin of loss may have grown when these things tank. Which brings us to the most hated superhero film in history, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. Now, why do I say that it's the most hated superhero film of all time? There probably have been some that have gotten worse critical reviews. We know there are. This is somewhere around 28% positive reviews on Rotten Tomato. And last week, when Dean and I spoke, we tried to address why it might be such a popular film at the box office, because it seemed like that's what was happening. And there was even a movement on social media called hashtag fuck the critics from people who love this movie. Well, it turns out those same people should who love the movie should be starting a new hashtag campaign called hashtag fuck the audience. Because the audience, it turns out, hates this movie as much as the critics do. And why do I know this? Well, I know this because it turns out, unlike what we reported last week, it was not setting any records for its opening weekend, not even non-summer, non-Christmas records. But the record it did set, kind of the record you never want to set, and that is the largest drop-off in box office from Friday to Sunday on opening week. That means that the word of mouth was terrible. And if there was any doubt about that, it was more than proven by the records Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice set in its second weekend. And realize that this is a second weekend where kids are still, many of them out of school for the Easter break, the spring break, and also where no new wide releases opened. Batman v Superman had the playing field to itself, and it had the largest tumble from first weekend to second weekend at the box office of any superhero film and of any movie ever to have a first weekend of $100 million or more. The biggest collapse from one week to the next. And these things, why do they matter? Well, they indicate, of course, that the audience hates it, and Warner Brothers is panicked and in full-on scramble mode. But looking at just the numbers, it matters, because if it had had a normal descent, even a halfway decent descent from Friday to Sunday on opening weekend, and then a normal 50% or even 60% fall from first weekend to second weekend, this movie would have ultimately turned a profit in theaters. I know what many people are thinking, but it's doing great overseas. But the financial split on money earned overseas is not the same way it works here. So Warner Brothers already knows that this film will still be in the red by the time its worldwide box office is counted. Ultimately, through video and cable and ancillary markets, it might turn a little bit of a profit. Of course, it's going to sell toys. It's launching other films. Oh, but is it? This is where they critically become terrified because this costs so much money just to break even. And now they've got so much money already invested in these other superhero films coming up. So what is Warner Brothers doing when we say that they're in scramble mode? Well, one of the things they're doing is they're now removing their support for the next Zack Snyder film, and they're putting that money towards what had long been rumored, Ben Affleck doing a standalone Batman film. And indeed, it was revealed this week that he has been writing a script for a standalone Batman film. They are going and taking by what is, from all accounts, is a good movie, the Suicide Squad film coming out in August, and they are doing reshoots of it to apparently try to add comedy and lightness to the film.
Oy vey.
Yeah, as if that's something you can add after the fact, but also as if the tone was necessarily the problem. As you know, those Chris Nolan Batman films, the Dark Knight films, there was no lightness or comedy in them, and they were quite popular.
Yes.
Now, maybe the audience has, as Dean and I long argued, has moved beyond that kind of tone with the Marvel's Avengers kind of showing the way of the sort of tone that audiences want to embrace now. So there might be something to the tone, but after the fact, reshoots... Tone is something where you got to ride the horse in the direction it's going.
Yeah.
And honestly, tone, I don't want to get into bashing Zack Snyder's film, but we were talking about how often in Spike Lee's movies, style and meaning become the tail that wagged the dog, and a story does not get told in any kind of satisfying way. Well, I'm beginning to realize... including movies like 300, including movies like Watchmen, which we both really enjoyed, the next time Zack Snyder tells a story in one of his movies might be the first time. He is excellent at world building or at universe building. But what was demanded of audiences in Batman versus Superman was to tell a story.
Well, the American habit of using actors as flesh bags for plot is needs to end.
Wow, but that is a... did you make up that phrase?
I did. I made it up.
Wow. That, if nothing else...
Because I have felt this way.
If nothing else, that just made this whole episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour worthwhile. It is
cutting it down to the bare necessity of exposition telling, as opposed to character development, character breadth and depth, is I don't know where Americans have gotten the idea that that's what we need to do, but it is not. It makes things feel longer than it is if you're not watching a real person.
And it's interesting because I think that that's part of the appeal for Deadpool, which is a Marvel superhero movie, though through Fox. But it's just become the all-time top-grossing R-rated film worldwide. And it really makes fun of that. It deconstructs how plot is disseminated to audiences.
Mm-hmm.
It completely breaks fourth wall every time to point out the artifice of how plot is revealed.
People don't go to see movies to hear plots. They go to connect and not feel alone in the world. And it doesn't matter if it's a superhero movie. If they recognize some kind of innate human flaw that they share with the character and feel, maybe they feel better about themselves, maybe, I don't know, maybe they learn something about themselves. That's really the point of storytelling and why people will keep going back.
People remember films and stories for the same reason that they remember other people. They remember them for how they made them feel. And plot doesn't make you feel anything.
No.
It's not to say that plot is unimportant. Plotting
right.
is how you lay out the elements upon which the story is revealed, and but story comes out of character. And so how a film makes us feel is really dependent upon the characters and the story and the tone of that story.
And not riffs, not comedic riffs. No more riffs, please.
And no meat bags? What was it? Flesh bags.
Flesh bags for plot development.
You know, it's sad to me that the makers of the Daredevil series on Netflix, although... it's new. It's really new makers, because the showrunner, Drew Goddard, has become an executive producer, but is off doing other things. And so season two of Daredevil dropped, and it's a big disappointment. And it's a big disappointment because I think they underestimated, the powers that be, underestimated how much of the feel of that show, the resonance of that show, was owed to Vincent D'Onofrio and his indelible performance, gargantuan performance as the villain, Wilson Fisk, in the first season. It leaves a gaping hole in season two that they try to fill with plot, and they try to fill with other characters, but there isn't anything that makes us feel the way that his storyline, the way that his character did. There is Joyz, to be sure. I mean, who's more charismatic and charming a bad guy than Pete Shinkoda returning as Nobu? That's delightful. The showdown between Nobu and Daredevil, delightful. But it's really a major step back. And in the wake of Jessica Jones being an even superior accomplishment over Daredevil, it feels even more disappointing.
I'm sorry.
Well,
for your loss.
At least you're sorry. As you know, I enjoy a good apology coming my way. Hey, back to movies, though. It is an interesting time right now because the summer movie season doesn't begin for a whole 4 weeks from now. Always begins beginning of May. And so April, there's some very interesting films that get released. One of which is Eye in the Sky, a drama about surveillance drones starring Helen Mirren, Aaron Paul, and in his final movie performance, Alan Rickman, and it's supposed to be top-notch. And how do you love that? Here's a thriller about surveillance drones starring a woman.
Mmm. I love that.
We mentioned The Witch that I want to catch, but another new release, a sports comedy from Richard Linklater, fresh off his groundbreaking Boyhood. He returns to his dazed and confused roots with Everybody Wants Some.
Mm-hmm.
And this looks delightful.
Mm.
You're skeptical.
Yeah, I'm skeptical.
I think this looks really, really good. And another one that is interesting. And see, I bring up these different films, The Witch, Eye in the Sky, Everybody Wants Some, and this next one, because April is sort of this refreshing time where a variety of different films, a diverse array of films, is managing to find room on the playing field, as opposed to what's about to happen starting May, where you will get programming and maybe, if you're lucky, counter programming.
April is a cool drink of water.
This first person shooter game.
Oof.
First-person shooter movie. Sorry, it's not a game. Hardcore Henry.
No water there, actually.
It's getting great reviews, and I, in watching it, was not surprised. I actually looked up what the reviews were after seeing a trailer, because something about it made me think they may just have pulled this off. This might be good. And so years from now, again, we'll be saying a la List comedy. The problem is not with the first one. The problem is with how easily copied it is. But I think the people who made this may have artfully told a story by using this new stylistic approach. And let's not forget that, honestly, the Oscar-winning filmmaker, first-time filmmaker of Son of Saul, used this approach in exploring the Holocaust.
Absolutely. I am going to give them the benefit of the doubt and think that they are making a large commentary on something, on violence, on whatever. But it looks sickening. I can't.
It does. A warning should be made. Friends of mine who have seen advanced screenings, have reviewed the films, do say that motion sickness is an issue in this film. So be prepared. But I thought you made a very telling point after we saw Son of Saul, that more or less you pointed out that this approach to the kind of subject matter where we are tied entirely with the point of view of the main character, it's all over the shoulder, you can only see what the character sees, and it's not widescreen. It's old-fashioned 1:3:3 in its aspect ratio because the director said, living, trying to survive in a concentration camp, you would learn immediately, don't look left, don't look right. Narrow your focus. What's straight ahead of you is all that you
will
see.
Wear blinders.
Wear blinders. And so we as the audience wear blinders. We only get to see what he sees. And in close-up, we get to see his reaction to those things. Obviously, in Hardcore Henry, we don't see the close-up reactions of the protagonist because we are the protagonist. It's truly first person. Son of Saul, in its own way, is the gateway drug to allow for something like Hardcore Henry. And as you said when we were departing after that screening, Son of Saul is a movie that could only have been made by someone of the video game playing generation.
Yes, he is a millennial, and this is a reality. This is going to become a genre. And like any genre, it just depends on the visionary behind it and whether it will be driven by meaning and art or commercial gain or both. I don't know.
I almost am hesitant to say this because it'll happen. Such is how influential your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour has become. A detective movie is absolutely one that I could see being made through this kind of first person approach, mm-hmm. because historically we're tied with the detective's point of view anyway.
I mean, it's been made on video games. The noir video games are a huge hit.
So there's that. I would like to point out, though, that there was a Humphrey Bogart vehicle back in the 40s. Do you remember this? With Lauren Bacall. Maybe the third film they did together called Dark Passage. And the whole beginning of the film is told entirely through the eyes of Humphrey Bogart, first person.
Hmm.
I think it's almost halfway through the movie before we see him. So there is some historic golden age of Hollywood precedence to this. We're almost out of time. I wanted to mention really quickly, though, some development news about films that are being made. Not just the films that are being released, but some that are in the process of being made. One that I'm quite excited about, I imagine you are too, Lil, Sicario 2 is not only happening, it's happening with all three stars, Benicio Del Toro, Emily Blunt, and Josh Brolin returning.
This is fantastic news.
Election, many of us who were fans of Election,
mm-hmm.
A reunion between director and star of Election, Alexander Payne and Reese Witherspoon, will not be happening.
Oh.
Alas, Reese Witherspoon apparently is too busy. That's the official word. And so she has been replaced by Kristen Wiig in Alexander Payne's sci-fi satire Downsizing, joining Matt Damon, who stars, along with Christoph Waltz, Alec Baldwin, Neil Patrick Harris, Jason Sudeikis. And the film follows an Omaha man in the not-too-distant future where humans are now able to shrink themselves to 1/8 their normal size as a means to battle overconsumption and the rapid depletion of Earth's natural resources. And our main character, played by Matt Damon, decides to undergo the process himself, joining others who have done the same. I'm so looking forward to
this. He's making Honey, I Shrunk the Kids 4. Is Rick Moranis in it?
You kind of ruined it. Speaking of ruining things, how desperate for cash must the Weinsteins be these days? They released about 5 years ago an amazing film from France called The Untouchables. Just a great one. You loved it. Dean loved it. I loved it. Who didn't love it? If you had two eyes and a heart, you loved this movie. The Weinsteins are remaking it. Not only starring Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston.
Hey.
You know, Bryan Cranston, we gave you the benefit of the doubt with Trumbo, despite how awful that was. There's no excuse in this.
If the documentary is superb, if the foreign film is superb, don't remake it. What's the point?
Exactly.
Why mess with greatness?
And especially when you're having Paul Feig write it. You can look forward to you can certainly look forward to Kevin Hart doing some list comedy in this. I guarantee you, if it's written by Paul
Feig,
there's
going to be a lot of riffs in that poor movie.
On the other hand, with how dreadful this Ghostbusters remake looks, Paul Feig needs to grab the money while he can, I think. Because I think the Ghostbusters might just be a... Batman versus Superman might have a run for its money at the Razzie Awards
this year.
You
don't want to rag on him because he's made huge steps for female protagonists.
And continues to do so.
Yes.
He just added a clause, an equity clause, to all of his future film contracts where it requires gender balanced casting in all supporting roles for any scripts that he is hired to write.
And I applaud that. That's amazing. And he's great.
And that's a great place to end this installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. You can find every installment at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can like the show on Facebook. Please do. Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at Dean and Phil. That's D-E-A-N. Spell out the and, A-N-D. P-H-I-L, Dean and Phil. Write us, won't you? ChillpackHollywood@yahoo.com. Special shout out to our loyal listener, Douglas Ratcliffe. Douglas, really enjoyed getting the emails from you and appreciated you sending along a review that you found in another podcast of Dean's Melbourne show. Understandably, we didn't discuss it because Dean couldn't be here. The
Dean.
Roof... is leaking. Lily, anything to plug before we go?
Yes, the Los Angeles Breakfast Club has a new Twitter handle, guys. So find out all the fun goings-ons at LA Breakfast Club.
Okay, thank you.
And if you're in the LA area, the LA Breakfast Club is having an Encore Sunday presentation on April 24th. You can find more information on that on our Facebook page. It will be a tribute to Natalie Cole and the songs her father wrote.
What's the Facebook page?
Facebook.com/LA Breakfast Club. Jamila Ford sings.
There you can learn about Dean Haglund's appearance on the 20th and this fantastic Encore Sunday concert on April 24th. Lily, you're done.
All right, all right. Jamila Ford sings Natalie Cole.
I'm cutting that out. Thanks. Thanks for jumping in.
Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.